This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety.
Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 103 of the Gunblog Variety Cast. How are you doing, Aaron?
Well, this week has been sort of a sine wave. It's been up and down and up again. First of all, I don't have a headache today. This is glorious because the past week has just been awful. As for down, some of you who know me know that I have a good friend called Dawn Faust Bibby, and she is dying of cancer. I promoted her GoFundMe to get her the treatment she needed. The good news is that she didn't get all the money she needed, and that's good because, as it turns out, she's really bad. She went down to Miami to get her chest drained of fluid, and they got a look at her liver. And her liver is just completely eaten up with cancer. So it suddenly went from, let's try and get money to get the procedure to save her, to, okay, now she's going to hospice. I took Monday off to go down and see her, and she's just a shadow of her former self. It was one of those things that I didn't want to do, but I had to do. And it was just such a weird thing, seeing someone alive and then saying goodbye with the full knowledge that I would never see her alive again. Well, the good news is that she's got closure. Her family and friends and her kids have all come by, and she's talked to them. And she said her goodbyes, and she's ready to go. And so now it's just a question of when the Lord takes her. So, Yeah, kind of a down. But getting back to the good news, she's not one of those people who fears death. She's got a very strong faith, and she's convinced that she's going to a better place. So she's looking forward to not being in pain and getting on with her affairs once she leaves the mortal world. So, you know, she's taking comfort in that, and that's good for the rest of us. She's showing us grace and courage in how to die. But as I said, it's been up and down. And so how about you, Sean?
Well, I put $300 down on my next handgun.
Well, how many handguns do you really need, Sean?
I need a new one. I need one in 9mm, so I'm buying a SIG P320 compact that will replace my XD45 ACP compact, which I've had since, if I carry it until Obama turns over to the next president, I will have carried it for 8 years.
So it's your Obama gun?
In fact, I did buy it during the first Obama gun rush.
Well, okay then.
I'm actually going to buy it from TSA, the Triangle Shooting Academy, not the Transport Security Administration or whatever they call themselves, but Triangle Shooting Academy, the only TSA anybody actually likes. I think I could probably get it for about $20 cheaper at another gun store, but I mean, TSA takes good care of us, and I thought, you know, they earned the sale. It wasn't worth $20 for me to wander in front of all my friends at TSA and go, look at the great deal I got for $20.
Yeah, you got to spread a little bread on the waters.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They've definitely spread some bread along the water, taking care of this blazing sword thing that we've been doing. So definitely they've earned it. So I still owe them $234. I could have paid a little more towards it. In fact, I might have been able to buy it outright, except I spent $90 for a new audio processor for the podcast. More on that later. And I contributed $70 to the rest of the money that was given for Aaron's new audio toys.
Yay! These things are awesome, guys. Thank you so much. I feel all high tech here. I swear, the H5, it It reminds me of a tricorder. It's got buttons. I have no idea what they do.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that my H6 does that I'm never going to do. I'm just not. But it does every single thing that I want for the podcast and more besides. So I'm really happy with it. And that was the reason I said, look, an H5 is what you need. You need an H5. You don't need the H6. You don't need the extra tracks, but you do need all the capabilities that that thing gives you over the H4, because I want you to be able to host the show when I go on vacation, which you will note in 103 episodes hasn't happened yet.
Well, you know, give it time. Eventually your wife will want to go on vacation and then it'll be the Weirdy and Pony show again.
No, not the Weirdy and Pony show.
Also, I could use this thing to do telephone interviews. And
yes.
I'm actually going to bring it along with me when I go to Big Three. I've been officially invited to the Big Three fall media event.
Uh-huh.
I can ask questions like I'm a professional and everything's going to be recorded. I won't have to scribble notes in a little notebook. It's really cool.
Well, see, we got a few things we still need to round out everything. We still need about $75 for this professional headphones that I use, which I think will do a whole lot better than those earbuds you've been using. And $60 for there's a capsule that goes on the top of that so that you get the extra two tracks for a four track input. Currently, the way the thing's set up, it comes with a built-in microphone, which if you go back to the episode where I went to the Silent Chico shoot, all of the on-location recording that I did with the built-in microphones on my H6. But if you want to be able to plug four microphones, or, you know, a microphone and the computer and that amp kit thing so that you can record on a, you know, telephone or Skype telephone or, you know, all that stuff where you're coming in from multiple sources, you need this like $60 capsule. So we still need a little bit extra money. So if you've got some, we'd be happy to take the donation. You can give those donations via PayPal buttons on the right sidebar of gunblogvarietycast.com. Or if you really hate PayPal, you can send us Amazon gift cards, which actually, to tell you the truth, are better because we don't lose any in transaction fees. And we're buying the audio equipment off of Amazon anyway. So, I mean, you're just paying for it right then and there. We could absolutely use some more donations. And we thank you so much for all of the donations we've gotten so far, because I think we've spent about $375, of which $70 came out of my own pocket. But the rest was given to us by you, the listener. So I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, I mean, big McLarge huge thanks to people who have done this. It really makes me feel good about what I'm contributing here, because there are times when I wonder, what the hell am I doing? Am I really accomplishing anything? And then people send in money for me to buy gear. It really is a solid affirmation. People saying, yes, we believe in you. We want you to do a better job. So here, improve your quality. And so thank you so much.
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
So anybody who donates $5 or more will get a sticker. Make sure if you send us Amazon gift cards to get me your address. If you do it via PayPal, I get your address so I can mail you a sticker. You've gotten some stickers, haven't you?
Yes, I have the cool limited edition stickers.
They are. These stickers are 2 inches by 2 inches, which having looked at them, I really think 3 inch by 3 inch is going to be a better sticker to have. I mean, I don't want to undersell these too much, but there are only 60. There will only ever be 60 2 inch by 2 inch stickers. So if you have them, they will be totally exclusive. So $5 donation or more. And if you don't want to give us money, but you still want to contribute to the show and you still want a podcast sticker, record a voicemail and send it to us, and if I play it on the show, I'll send you a sticker. Beth is on assignment and will return next week.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly, and a little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Woman sought after two dead in shootout during Cumberland County robbery. Dateline Eastover, North Carolina. Cumberland County authorities are looking for a woman wanted in connection with an attempted robbery that left two people dead in Eastover Sunday morning. New developments have led Cumberland County Sheriff's Office detectives to a woman they believe is associated with the persons involved in the shootout. Detectives are trying to locate person of interest 21 of Fayetteville in order to question her about the shooting. According to authorities, a woman and a robbery suspect were both shot to death at a house in Eastover just after 3:15 a.m. when a homeowner and a would-be thief got into a shootout during an attempted robbery. Deputies responded to 2516 Culbreth Drive.
Stop by and say hi.
In response to a 911 call for a robbery. The caller told dispatchers that someone had been shot. Upon arrival, deputies found two gunshot victims. Both were transported to Cape Fear Valley Medical Center, where they were pronounced dead. Victim 2, who lives at the home and was the one who called the authorities, told CBS North Carolina Sunday afternoon that he shot and killed the robbery suspect during the attempted robbery. The woman who was killed, Victim 1, was Victim 2's girlfriend. Victim 1 was shot by the robber during the exchange of gunfire, Victim 2 said. Victim 2 said the incident began when he and his girlfriend were arriving home and a robber came from behind them saying, "You know what this is." The robber pulled out a gun, as did Victim 2, and shots were exchanged, he said. According to authorities, once the shooting stopped, Victim 1 fell to the floor of the porch. She was mortally wounded and was later pronounced dead at Cape Fear Valley Medical Center. One of the robbery suspects was found a short distance away, lying on the ground. He too suffered a gunshot wound and was later pronounced dead at the hospital. The suspect has been identified by Cumberland County Sheriff's Office as Suspect 1, 33 of Fayetteville. Victim 2 said he's devastated by the death of his girlfriend. He said he and Victim 1 were still mourning the death of their newborn daughter, who died a couple of weeks ago. On Sunday afternoon, blood was still visible near the front doorstep of the house. On Sunday, a neighbor said the area is typically very quiet and added, "No one deserves to die, but thank God the homeowner had a gun." The sheriff's office is requesting that if anyone has any information regarding the whereabouts of person of interest or any other information related to the case, that they please contact the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office or Crime Stoppers.
There's nothing happy or exciting about this at all.
But wait, it gets worse.
I'm sure.
Suspect 1, resisting officer, misdemeanor class 2, maintain any place controlled substance, felon class I, possess schedule 2, felon class I, manufacture schedule 6, felon class H, possess with intent to sell schedule 2, felon class H, 2 counts trafficking schedule 2, felon class G, and possession of a firearm by a felon, felon class G. That was the dead robber. Victim 2, the armed homeowner, larceny, felon from South Carolina, 3 counts possess with intent to sell schedule 6, felon class I, possess Schedule 1, Felon Class I, and possession with intent to sell Schedule 2, Felon Class H.
So considering that both of them have convictions for possession with intent to sell, why do we get the feeling one drug dealer was robbing another drug dealer?
That's kind of what I was getting. Baron is on assignment and will return next week. And in our main topic segment, Aaron, I understand you want to talk about something called ITAR, and the State Department and gunsmiths. Now, I'm kind of, you know, making light of it. I have heard of this, but to be honest, it's kind of technical. I'm not a gunsmith, and I haven't paid a great deal of attention to it. Could you kind of explain what's going on here?
I would be happy to, Sean. This actually has me so upset that I am in full-on nerd rage about it. I'm going to try to keep my thoughts coherent and logical, but please understand that just talking about this gets me very worked up, so get your finger on the censor button because I might just start swearing. So, before I go off on a rant, let me explain what ITAR is and what it does before I explain how this latest regulatory clarification is both a perversion of the original intent of ITAR and a gross violation of rights. ITAR is an acronym for International Traffic in Arms Regulations, and it was created in 1976 to prevent American companies from exporting arms to countries or entities that were hostile to the United States. Basically, it was don't export arms to other countries, don't fund the various guerrillas, don't do things like that. Since then, its role has expanded to include certain technologies, for example, some kinds of night vision that give our country or our military an edge. And so we heavily restrict the export of those technologies so that the bad guys don't get it. And it's important to note that technologies can mean concepts as well as material, such as new manufacturing techniques and the like. Now, I am practically a First Amendment absolutist over here. I believe very strongly in free speech, but I do understand the reasoning behind ITAR. Put simply, we don't want Al-Qaeda or Daesh to have access to the same arms and tech that our warfighters have. So in that regard, I grudgingly accept the necessity of ITAR being able to tell companies to whom they may sell their property. But this most recent regulatory clarification, hoo-hoo boy. I've attached a couple of PDFs for people who want to read it for themselves, and I'll paraphrase for everyone else. And a big thank you goes out to firearms law attorney Benjamin M. Blatt, Esquire, for helping me decipher the legalese and putting it into simple English. If you need a lawyer in Indiana, he's your man. So the short version here is that the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls, DDTC, has just decided, because, you see, much like the ATF, this unelected bureaucracy gets to define the regulations it then enforces. And it has decided that, and I quote here, many, but not all, traditional gunsmithing activities do not constitute manufacturing for ITAR purposes and, therefore, do not require registration with the DDTC. Or, put another way, they have unilaterally and without legislative oversight decided that a lot of gunsmithing tasks do indeed require ITAR registration, a process which, by the way, takes around 2 months and around $2,250 a year. So by making these requirements, they're going to put many, many gunsmiths out of business. Why? Because fuck you, that's why. So let's look at these terrible technologies that ITAR is going to regulate. Use of any special tooling or equipment upgrading in order to improve the capability of assembled or repaired firearms. Modifications to a firearm that change round capacity. The production of firearm parts, including, but not limited to, barrels, stocks, cylinders, breech mechanisms, triggers, silencers, or suppressors. The systemized production of ammunition, including the automated loading or reloading of ammunition. The machining or cutting of firearms, e.g. threading of muzzles or muzzle brake installation requiring machining that results in an enhanced capability, rechambering firearms through machining, cutting, or drilling, chambering, cutting, or threading barrel blanks, and finally, blueprinting firearms by machining the barrel. So yes, you heard right. The DDTC is protecting us from the terrible scourge of 19th century technology known as drilling, tapping, and threading. Who knew that a simple drill press and lathe could produce such awful high-tech restricted capabilities such as, and I shudder to say this aloud, putting a scope on a rifle?
Ooh.
I don't see how anyone can interpret this as anything less than an overt f*** you to the gun industry and to firearms owners who want to modify their rifles. Want to put a suppressor on your rifle? Screw you! Your gunsmith can't thread the barrel unless he spent thousands to become ITAR compliant. Now, some of you may be wondering how precisely the DDTC has authority over gunsmiths in this regard. After all, wasn't ITAR designed to prevent the export of guns and high-tech components? How could this possibly affect American citizens doing work for other American citizens domestically? That's a great question. And again, put simply, ITAR has been given jurisdiction over things called defense articles, quote unquote. How does one define a defense article? Well, that would be in the second PDF I have attached in the notes, but the easy answer is practically all guns are defense articles.
Well, I'm not sure I would argue with that. I mean, basically every gun out there is something I can use for defense, both individual defense and collective defense, right?
That's true, but they're talking in terms of national defense. So the very first category says non-automatic and semi-automatic firearms to caliber 50 inclusive, which is practically every gun we can own legally.
Yeah, that's everything.
But wait, it gets better. Okay, so further categories specify automatic weapons up to 50 cal, shotguns with a barrel less than 18 inches, sound and flash suppressors, rifle scopes manufactured to military specifications, and most scopes these days are, and barrels, cylinders, frames, and breech systems. A regular pump-action shotgun might get a pass. Except there's a category which states firearms or other weapons having a special military application regardless of caliber. I'm pretty sure that the Army issues Mossberg 590s to its military police. So basically, all guns. And of course, all the components and ammunition for the above. That's in later sections. Here's what this means for you, based on my knowledge and understanding of what Mr. Blatt Esquire told me. If you're a gunsmith, you're screwed unless you pay the ITAR registration. And even if you do, you have to wait until your forms are processed, which could take longer than 2 months if a bunch of people, like, say, all the gunsmiths in the United States, suddenly applied. If you want to have your gun modified by a gunsmith to take a suppressor, scope, or have it rechambered, you're going to have to wait until your gunsmith pays his tribute and is licensed. Otherwise, anything you have done to it will be illegal. I don't know if you will get in trouble for that, but your gunsmith sure will. Fortunately, this is all for commercial enterprises. If you do this in your own garage with your own tools, you ought to be okay. For now, at least. Likewise, if you allow your buddy to use your tools. I'm not sure how the law would regard a buddy paying you in beer and pizza to mod your gun for him, because that's some degree of transaction, but I sure wouldn't risk it. Regular gunsmith repairs to a broken gun are fine, so long as they don't involve that bleeding-edge, high-tech process known as cutting, threading, drilling, and tapping, except if such things don't change the capability of the gun. For example, if you already have a drilled and tapped scope mount, and you want iron sights installed, that ought to be okay. Then, drilling and tapping is perfectly legal. Clear as mud, right? Cosmetic additions and engravings are okay, as are adding accessories that don't require those dark 19th century machining arts. So you could have a gunsmith install a suppressor for you as long as the barrel was already threaded, but you couldn't have him thread it for you unless he was ITAR compliant. Now, according to Attorney Blatt, there's an exception on the CFR munitions list for shotguns under 50 caliber without military application, so gunsmiths should be able to go hog wild on 410s and 20 gauges without registering for ITAR. So there's that. I'm not sure if that's a silver lining or just an oversight on DDTC's part. Finally, and surprisingly, manual reloaders are okay. Actually, it says manual loading or reloading of ammunition of 50 caliber or smaller, so it could be argued that this doesn't apply to 12-gauge shotgun ammo. But this seems aimed at systemic production of ammunition, and I'm not sure if the higher-end personal reloaders, such as from Dillon, count as automated loading or reloading. I think this is more likely a measure meant to screw with ammunition manufacturers, like Remington, Winchester, and the like. The big companies will just pay the fine. They've got the cash. They've got the army of lawyers. But these smaller companies, like, say, Freedom Arms, may go out of business because of this. So, welcome to the final days of the Obama administration, where our petty and passive-aggressive coward-in-chief is going to screw with gun owners and the gun industry as much as possible because he lacked the wherewithal to actually pass the gun control legislation he wanted. And there's probably more of this crap ahead, too. I've attached another PDF that talks about the Firearm and Ammunition Excise Tax, or FAET. And of course, there are all the nasty rumors going about how the EPA wants to define ammunition as hazardous or toxic, and how OSHA wants to implement ammunition storage laws. And they're all trying to find some sort of creative backdoor. And yes, double entendre fully intended, backdoor means to screw with us. So, how do we fight this current regulatory clarification? Reading through it, you see many references to, quote, the ordinary, contemporary, common meaning for gunsmithing, unquote. This means the DDTC is not using a legal definition for what gunsmithing is. And as we know by now, there are lots of legal terms of art in use. For example, such as how the ATF doesn't define a black powder gun as a firearm. So, it ought to be relatively easy to legally define what gunsmithing is and what gunsmithing entails as exempt and outside of the common meaning of manufacturing. And that would short-circuit a lot of this bullshit. But how would we do it? If just 1,000 gunsmiths contributed $50, that would form an excellent war chest to fight this on a legislative basis. Unfortunately, no one has yet set up a legal defense fund for this, so I can't tell you where to send your money. But if, for example, there was a gunsmith organization willing to raise the money, Prince Law definitely has the experience in federal administrative law disputes to deal with this. I'm just saying. So regardless, if you know someone in the legal world who has the time and inclination to create a way to fight this, then you bug the shit out of them to do it. Because we have to fight this garbage, and we have to fight it now.
Yeah, wow, Aaron, that's nuts.
I have strong feelings on this matter is what I'm saying.
No, I'm not concerned about your strong feelings. I'm talking about ITAR being used. It really, I can't understand how this can't be viewed. How they can, with a straight face, say, well, no, we're just, this is just us trying to make the world safer. It's not, honestly, really, no, we're not just doing this to screw with you people.
Yeah, and so part of the trick is going to be when you fight it, fighting it in a locale that is friendly to us, because if you go up against the government, they're going to try and stack the deck and, you know, have it tried before, like, the Ninth Circus, and you can guess how well that's going to go, so.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, we need to deal with this. So somebody needs to put something together now and get to fighting. We need to make sure that we're not in a position where the next president goes, oh yes, all that and more.
What the gun world really needs right now, we need a pro-gun Bloomberg. We need someone who is willing to just donate millions to help with the legislative fight. In the same way that Bloomberg is trying to buy elections, we need someone who's willing to just, oh, you want to fight this? Here, have $10 million as a legal defense account.
Yeah.
That'd be wonderful.
And now a word from our sponsor. You know what will happen. If you ever have to defend yourself, you're going to end up in handcuffs. Are you trained to win the fight after the fight? Sure, you can draw, aim, and put two in the 10 ring, but have you learned your legal self-defense? Do you know the law? Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for your legal self-defense class. Each class is tailored to the laws in your state. Attorney Andrew Branca will teach you the law. Not just what the law says, but what the judge's legal opinions say. What the jury instructions say. Sure, you could risk spending the rest of your life in prison because you followed the advice of some gun store counter jockey. Or you could spend the day with the man who literally wrote the book on the law of self-defense. Carry a gun so you're hard to kill. Know the law so you're hard to convict. Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for a legal self-defense class in your state. And make sure to use discount code VARIETY at checkout to receive 10% off. If a terrorist saying that Americans are dumb because our lax gun laws isn't a good argument for gun control, what is? Tiffany says, not so fast. This argument isn't as valid as it first might seem. So hey, Tiffany, what's going on this week?
Hey, Sean. So have you seen this recent article where the New York Times interviewed an ISIS fighter who's currently locked up in a German prison?
No, actually, I haven't.
Yeah, he had some pretty interesting things to say about our gun laws. Check it out.
They say Americans, they're dumb that because they have open gun policies. It's as easy to get radical Muslims to buy guns. They say we can radicalize them easily, and if they don't have no criminal record, they can buy them guns themselves. We don't need to have no contact man who has to provide guns for them.
That just basically verifies everything that the anti-gunners say. Oh, we need to close the terror gap. We need to have stiffer gun control laws because these terrorists are just going to buy guns in the country and use those guns on us.
Well, you know, okay, let's take a look at this in a bit more detail. I have to admit, when I first heard this, it struck a chord. You know, I'm just going to be perfectly honest. It hit me right in the old sort of anti-gun funny bone, if you will. And I thought to myself, wow, if terrorists see our Second Amendment as an exploitable loophole, if they see it as some sort of terror facilitator, then how can that possibly be a good thing? Or at least I know that's what I would have thought 15 or 20 years ago before I had much real perspective on the Second Amendment. Now, the reason I thought that this would be interesting to discuss in a segment called The Bridge is that it, for one thing, it kind of speaks to the dangers of what I call absolutism. It's always dangerous, in my humble opinion, to take an absolutist viewpoint, which is to say, you know, when you blindly dismiss any remotely conceivable counterargument as ludicrous or nonsensical or just unworthy of even an ounce of consideration, the stuff of crazy talking, demented radicals. That's real easy to say. It's an easy route to take, but it's kind of lazy. And more importantly, it's ineffective and counterproductive, I think. So, of course, if somebody says, if an anti-gunner says, hey, guns secretly come to life every night and autonomously maraud around town accosting people, then yes, that's an argument that I think you can safely ignore and decline to even entertain. But when a known, admitted, convicted terrorist who traveled to Syria and trained with ISIS and witnessed beheadings tells the New York Times on camera that ISIS leaders are reveling in mirth at just how exploitable American gun laws are, that's not something you can cavalierly dismiss, especially when coupled with the fact that, truly, guns in mass killings here in the U.S. often are purchased legally. If we do that, if the pro-gun community just dismissively scoffs at these kind of counterarguments by anti-gunners, I think we run the risk of losing our own credibility and being branded as hypocrites, especially since we so often accuse gun control advocates of abandoning logic in pursuit of, you know, thoughtless dogma or a doctrinal fidelity. We just can't afford to do that. So as I initially recoiled at hearing this terrorist celebrate the Second Amendment, rather than ignoring that visceral reaction, I had to own it. And I don't think it's necessarily a showing of weakness or a slight to my own argument to admit that a potential counterargument is powerful, at least at first blush. So rather than saying, man, screw that guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and the anti-gunners are crazy and they don't know what they're talking about, I think the better tactic for pro-Second Amendment advocates would probably be to explain why that kind of argument is only powerful at first blush and why it's a lot less compelling when you take the time to unpack it.
So how is it only compelling at first blush?
Let's back up for a minute and kind of think about things from a broader perspective. I think more than anything else, most people would agree that America was founded on the concept of balance, right? All rights have to be balanced against each other, or else you have anarchy. My right to free speech, for example, can't trump your right to enjoy peace and quiet in your own home. And I think the same is true here. We have to balance freedom and security. And that's become a bit of a cliche, but it's something we have to keep in mind. And more importantly, it's something that those who are anti-Second Amendment have to keep in mind. So to my gun-averse friends who may feel vindicated by this terrorist celebrating quote-unquote lax American gun laws, I would say to them, please know that the issue is far more complex than that. And we, as pro-gun advocates, we have to keep in mind and acknowledge and remind folks when we're confronted with these arguments that the issue is more complex than that. First of all, no honest student of the Second Amendment can ever deny that firearms can be used in dangerous and deadly ways when wielded in the wrong hands for the wrong reasons. But as Weird said last week, the terrorists in Nice did a lot more damage with a truck than any terrorist or murderer, for that matter, has done in the United States with a gun. And that's with modern semi-automatic firearms, long guns or handguns, and in some instances, multiple firearms, like in Newtown and Virginia Tech. And in some instances, even with multiple people with multiple firearms, like at Columbine or in San Bernardino. Look at it this way. Let's use an analogy. Suppose there were a napkin in your kitchen that caught fire. My guess is that you wouldn't douse your entire home with water and chemicals, right? Of course you wouldn't. Neither would you ban all napkins from your home. Hell, you probably wouldn't ban fire from your home. Instead, you would focus like a laser on extinguishing the potentially catastrophic but still relatively narrow threat posed by this inopportune alignment of two things that are much more dangerous in combination than in isolation. Has nothing to do with the rightness or wrongness of any of those two individual things separately. And I think the same logic applies to terrorists, these few terrorists who condescend about America's freedoms. So please don't allow yourself to be terrorized by a terrorist is what I would say to, you know, the gun control advocate who attempts to use this man's so-called testimony in support of their claims. A terrorist's job, a terrorist's craft, is manipulation. And whatever use they may think they have for our Second Amendment is utterly irrelevant. The day we start fashioning our laws and indeed our very constitution around what terrorists want or think is the day we lose not just a battle, but the entire war.
All right, Tiffany, it was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Sean. I hope this gives folks stuff to think about. But until next time, everybody stay safe and keep it centered and even.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette.
All right, Erin. So since you took most of the main topic segment, I figured I was going to jump in on your Blue Collar Prepping. I want to ask you a couple of questions here that I'd really like an answer to. And I'm pretty sure there's other people out there who are considering prepping or looking at it going, I don't know, that they want an answer to this. So, Erin, what good is it going to do to prepare for the end of the world? I mean, like, everybody's going to die anyway, or it's just going to be so awful. Why should I prepare for, like, the zombie apocalypse or total breakdown of society? I mean, can you even prepare for that?
Okay, that's a question that actually has two answers, really. The first answer is you don't prepare for the end of the world. If you do that, you're going to get overwhelmed with the enormity of it all. Instead, like I've said before, you prepare for what is more likely. You prepare for a disaster that'll take about 3 days. You prepare for losing power, a blizzard, a hurricane that knocks out bridges. You prepare for that. And the second answer is you do it not just to survive. You do it to, well, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know that if I lose power in August because of a storm or if we've got a hurricane that's coming in, I want to remain as comfortable as possible. I don't want to be stuck in my house with no air conditioning, sweating my butt off. I want to be as comfortable as possible because I'm attached to my creature comforts. So yeah, I'm going to prepare so that I have a battery backup so that I can run my box fan so that I can sleep at night. So it's about getting through the suck. And if you can get through the suck, then incrementally, you will be prepared for longer and bigger and more terrible things. You're never going to really prepare for the end of the world. You're basically just going to be comfortable through the decline. And that's really the best you can do there. But again, it shouldn't ever be doom and gloom. It's not the end of the world. It's getting through this imminent disaster right now.
Well, doesn't your family think you're crazy?
My family doesn't, fortunately, because we've lived in Florida for coming on 30 years now, and we've lived through hurricanes, we've lived through the fires of 98, where every county was on fire, and we're a military family. So I believe I mentioned this before, but when we moved to Germany in 1979, my father was one of the people working on the fold-a-gap strategy, which is, you know, if the Russians were ever going to invade Europe by land, they were going to come through the fold-a-gap. And I was told from a very young age, hey, at some point, Daddy may get a call in the middle of the night. He's going to go off to war. You and Mommy are going to have to grab your luggage and your forms, and you'll get on a plane and you'll fly back to the United States and, you know, leave behind my dog and all my toys and all those other things. And so from that young age, well, young age for me, not so much for my parents, but we've always had that you may have to bug out concept. But there are other people, I hear it a lot on prepping boards, how do I get my wife, girlfriend, grandmother, mom to take this seriously and not think I'm crazy? The best way to do this is to start small. Don't lead off with the zombie apocalypse. Well, unless they're fans of Walking Dead. If they're fans of Walking Dead, you've got an in. Which is why, actually, the recent post-apocalyptic stuff with that and Revolution and NBC were really good jumping-off points conversationally. You go, well, hey, what if this happened in real life? But what you do is you point out the concrete examples, such as the blackout in New York in 2003, or the, well, God, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, or the Boston bomber when the city was on lockdown. You know, you look at those examples and you say, well, okay, if we were prepared, you know, would we be as worried? And you basically use events in the news as examples. And you start off with your family and you say, well, what if something like that happened here? How would we react? Do you think we should maybe have a plan? And again, if you live in a state that's prone to natural disasters, that's where you jump off from. If you live in California, you have to deal with earthquakes on a regular basis. You're going to go, well, you know, we are probably going to have an earthquake at some point. We need an earthquake plan. And you start from there. And if you start doing it as a logical process of, if this thing happens, we need to do this, we need to have this in hand, it's no longer that big, scary prepping for the end of the world. It's you're taking sensible precautions for something that's probably going to happen. And so if you approach it from that regard, rather than prepping for the end of the world, the zombies are going to rise, we're going to have to eat our neighbors, you know, you'll be taken a lot more seriously.
So why are you so selfish, though? I mean, you're just hoarding all this stuff to yourself.
Hoarding is something that's been mentioned a lot. And there are some schools of thought among preppers that actually maintain a small store of supplies to give to people because they feel it's their Christian duty. And I can't tell them that they're wrong, but there is a danger that comes with that. If you are known to be the person who has supplies and everyone in the neighborhood is starving, then they're going to come to you and they're going to break down the door of your house and take your food. And if you resist, there might be injury. And so that's why preppers maintain OPSEC, because, well, honestly, our responsibility is to protect our family first and our neighbors second. It's not so much selfish as it is, if we give things away, we might lose everything. The second answer to that is, in a way, it's not selfish, and here's why. Because when a disaster strikes, FEMA will show up and, well, they ought to be handing out food and water and medical supplies. If you're a prepper, you won't need that. So not only will you not need to take the food, water, medical supplies from FEMA, but now they have more to give to everyone else. So it's not so much me, 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 me. It's I have taken care of myself so that the limited resources that are left to go around will go further for other people. And if everyone does that, then these resources will go furthest of all.
So if somebody's interested in learning more about prepping, where can they learn it?
Well, I encourage people to go to my website, bluecollarprepping.com, where we have excellent articles on how to prep on a budget. And most of the time, we have articles 5 days a week.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. The ongoing saga of Massachusetts' bizarre reinterpretation of their long-standing assault weapons ban continues as Attorney General Maura Healey digs her heels in. In This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
So last week I covered Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey's press conference outlining her radical and bizarre reinterpretation of Massachusetts' 18-year-old assault weapons ban. The assault weapons ban that is literally a direct copy of the federal assault weapons ban of 1994. Since then, the governor has reversed course and challenged her reinterpretation of what was established state law, as well as the bulk of Massachusetts' legislature. Both Democrat and Republican have called for her to rescind her actions. There have been multiple political rallies against the AG, and multiple laws filed to reverse her actions and strip her office of the powers she has so wantonly abused. And amidst all this political commotion, she went on Boston Public Radio to double down on her radical decision.
Five former Massachusetts attorneys general did something pretty unusual today. They joined together to publicly support current AG Maura Healey after she was criticized by lawmakers and questioned by Governor Charlie Baker about her ban on so-called copycat assault weapons. Former AGs Frank Bellotti, Jim Shannon, Scott Harshbarger, Tom Riley, and Martha Coakley issued a statement saying, quote, Attorney General Healey's actions are constitutional, lawful, and consistent with the mission of her office.
Man, Sean, don't I hate how NPR hosts sound. They just want to lull you to sleep with their smarmy tones.
So yeah, it was unusual for former AGs to rally behind a sitting AG. It's also bizarre that three of those AGs were in office while this law was in place. All of these AGs are progressive Democrats with strong anti-Second Amendment views. Yet Mara Healey is the only AG in Massachusetts or any other state to see the magic writing between the lines that defines an assault weapon under this law. Think about the number of legal minds that have been dealing with this law since it was first drafted back in 1993, who never saw this implication. Either Mara Healey is the greatest legal mind of our time, or she is making shit up as she goes along. Which do you think it is?
For the last 18 years in this state, we have had on the books an assault weapons ban. It bans assault weapons, but it also bans copycats or duplicate versions of those weapons. What we've seen over the last several years is that we've seen sales of these copycat weapons. And today I'm making clear that copycats of assault weapons are still assault weapons and are banned under the law. And that's what the announcement last week was about.
No, there were no copycat weapons sold in Massachusetts. The law was clear that if a firearm did not have the features of a banned weapon, it was compliant. Not only did her Massachusetts predecessors see it that way, but everybody in the entire country saw it that way as well.
I think in this time where we have had more mass shootings than calendar days last year alone, we've seen a terrible run of mass shootings lately. I viewed it as my obligation, frankly, after Orlando, to take a look at what was happening with respect to our own state assault weapons ban.
I know she said this crap in her press conference, but I thought since she was repeating the lie, I'd repeat the truth. No, there haven't been more mass shootings than calendar days last year alone. There were 6 mass shootings in 2015, and they are not on the rise. Also, I might add that they aren't happening in Massachusetts either. Hell, nobody was murdered with a rifle of any kind in 2014, the latest year the FBI has released records for. So she's lying about the law, and she's lying about crime. What else is she lying about?
Two of the main issues that have come up, one from State Public Safety Secretary Daniel Bennett, who says that there's some uncertainty about guns because of your notice last week and your explanation of a two-part test to determine whether a weapon is a real copy or not. I don't even know if you can say that, real copy, but apparently is it confusing for people?
I don't think it's confusing at all. I think gun dealers know exactly what we're talking about. I think the public knows what we're talking about when we're talking about an assault weapon.
Lie. But she goes further.
The good news is, I think that what we've seen is gun dealers have complied with this. And I think that that just shows that there is no confusion about this, because when we issued the enforcement notice, we did see a spike in sales that day. That happens a lot whenever there's action around guns. And frankly, that's what happens whenever you see a mass shooting. One of the things that was very sad to me is that in the wake of Orlando, sales of these style assault weapons, copycat weapons, rose 450% in Massachusetts.
Right. And the Boston Globe does say that sales of these guns continue despite your enforcement notice last week.
No. Let me tell you what's happened, Deborah. And what's happened is most significant and shows that there is no confusion about this. There were sales of these weapons, a couple thousand of them, last week. We are now down to about 20 sales yesterday.
No, gun dealers are so confused at what she might be referring to now as an assault weapon that they're not selling anything at all. Further, while she has time to help fellow gun banner Hillary Clinton's nomination for president at the convention in Philadelphia, and she has time to field softball questions on NPR, what she hasn't done is answer the letters from the governor, more than half the legislators, and the Secretary of Public Safety to clarify her ambiguous statements. To this date, there is no list to find what guns actually are legal in Massachusetts.
Gun dealers have stopped selling these. Importantly, gun manufacturers have stopped advertising these weapons as, quote, Massachusetts compliant, which is what they used to do. And our point is, it is not the gun manufacturers or dealers who get to decide what is lawful in the state. We get to decide as a state what is lawful in the state, and that's what last week's announcement is about.
The manufacturers marketed those guns as Massachusetts compliant because they were complying with the law. They didn't interpret the law. They sat down with state and federal authorities, as well as their lawyers, to confirm that they were in full compliance with the law. Now she says they were directly violating it. Again, Either she's the greatest legal mind in the history of our country, or she's just making up as she goes along. Occam's razor says...
I would never act in a way that wasn't without authority. This is, again, something that I think is not only appropriate, but necessary right now, given what we've seen.
Good Lord. I would never act without authority should be the words written on her tombstone. Instead, she's giving the interview from the Democrat National Convention where the party chair was forced to resign under allegations of rampant corruption and disruption of the democratic process, and where Hillary Clinton, who is all but admitted to multiple federal felonies, as well as incompetent mishandling of state secrets, has been nominated for the president of the United States. What should be grounds for a federal, if not state, indictment has just become business as usual. We in Massachusetts will continue to fight until our good names are cleared. And to those in the unoccupied territories, remember, if they can do this to us, they can also do it to you. If you'd like to help out the cause, I urge you to donate to the Gun Owners Action League at goal.org.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week. Auphonic.
Gesundheit.
Exactly. In fact, I think it's actually a bunch of German dudes that wrote it. Now, I talked about it earlier in the show about a new audio, I don't really know what to call it exactly, but it's a production tool. It's a program for your computer. This is for the podcasters out there. If you were doing anything with professional audio, or you're attempting at least to have professional sounding audio, which every podcaster should be shooting for, number one thing you should do is get yourself a decent microphone, which costs you $50-$60 on Amazon. But after that, Auphonic is the key. I just found this maybe 2 weeks ago. It was something that Luke from Triangle Tactical Podcast, he texted me. He says, hey, do you know anything about this negative 16 LUFS? And I was forced to admit that I had never even heard of LUFS, had no idea why negative 16 of them was good. And I did some research and I found out that there is a sort of a new-ish standard where all podcast, all audio that is put out in a podcast format should be at a certain sound level, a certain volume. And there's so many different ways you can measure volume. If you don't measure it correctly, if you use a different way, then everybody's in all these different audio levels. And anybody who listens to a lot of podcasts knows this. Some podcasts are really quiet and some podcasts are really loud. And you're turning your volume up and down as you go between the two. And the solution to that is one broadcast standard of negative 16 LUFS, which stands for loudness unit for short, because there's a long actual name for it. And they gave an acronym for the acronym. It's kind of funny.
Sort of like GNU, not Unix.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, how do you do this? If you're using Adobe's audio editing software, there is some sort of a procedure for you to change the loudness units. But in Audacity, which most of us use the freeware, it doesn't exist. And there's a lot of things you want to do to your audio as a podcaster. You know, you compress the audio, you sound gate it, you do a lot of things to get rid of audio artifacts that don't involve you physically going and like eliminating them all the way through. And they can be really difficult. And you honestly, podcaster, when you're starting out, you have no freaking idea what you're doing. And even at 103 episodes, there's a lot of stuff I haven't the slightest idea how to do. And I wish I knew how, but I don't. Auphonic basically automates all that crap for you. So go to auphonic.com, and what you'll find is they have an online editing tool that compresses and sound gates and audio levels and sets the loudness units. You know, it makes it just the right volume throughout that, and you know, it's even, and it takes two people that are a different audio level and levels them out so they're the same. So you don't have one guy really loud and one guy really quiet. It does all of that for you. All you have to do is upload the tracks to it. They both have to start and stop at the same time, but you load the two tracks in, or just one track if that's all you've got, just one microphone, and you put it in there, and it just does all of that stuff for you and spits you out an MP3, a wave, whatever you want it to spit it out in. It'll take care of that for you. Now, I have multiple tracks, when I'm doing recordings, I have three tracks going. So then it'll take all three of those tracks. It'll identify what's music and it won't compress it and mess it up. It'll just change how loud it is. And it'll mix everything together in just the right level. It's really, really fantastic. If you noticed last week's show, you didn't have to adjust the volume during the show because everything was just the same volume. That was Ophonic. I used their trial version for a week just to do one full production, and I liked it so much that I spent the $90 and just got the desktop version of it, and I'm using that. If you want to try it out for a bit of time longer than a week, you can use their online version. It's 2 hours free per month. If you pay $11, you can get 9 hours a month, and that should get most weekly one-hour podcasters. That should be enough for you, $11. But if you do the math, $11 times 8 months, there you are. There's the desktop version. So I realized very quickly it was going to work for me, so I just went ahead and bought it. This thing noise gates, compresses. It has an adaptive leveler. It mixes everything together, hums. If you listen to 3 episodes ago, listen to Baron's segment and tech tips, and listen to last week's tech tips, you'll notice that for weeks and weeks, there was a hum behind Baron. And if you listen to last week's, gone. It takes all that hums, the clipping, some background noises out. All that stuff is handled. It sets the podcast level to the right volume. And it's like this broadcast standard of negative 16, whatever, however they measure that. There's math in there that I don't get. Here's a fun one. If you've ever recorded with two microphones in the same room, you'll know I get loud on one, and then the sound of my voice is going to be on the other track. And it's really freaking annoying to edit that. Well, guess what? You run it through this, it does something called cross-gating. It says, oh, I've got that sound over here. I don't need it on that track. And that track is the quieter one, so I'll just electronically eliminate it. And it goes away. It is incredibly cool. And if you do a podcast, try it out. You're going to love it. And you'll end up spending the $90 and getting it. Now, there's two versions. There's a single track version, and there's the multi-track production version. Get the multi-track because you should be recording things on multiple tracks. You should be having people record locally and put it together yourself in Audacity. It's not that difficult. Figure it out. And if you have something that's single track, like if you listen to last week's Pacifiers and Peacemakers, you'll note that it was a monologue. It was just, she recorded something and sent it to me. So there was only one track. Well, I just uploaded her track to the online editor and used some of my 2 hours free for the month. And I processed the single track there. And then all of the multi-track stuff, which was much, much more time that I'm recording, that's where I did it in the desktop version, which I paid the, you know, well, in this case, last week I was still using the trial, 1 week trial, but I went and paid for that $90 today. I can't say enough about it. It's really awesome. Go to auphonic.com, auphonic.com, and sign up for it. Once you're done the physical editing part, right? Don't sound gate, don't compress, don't do any of that. Just edit the parts you want out, silence bits on different tracks to get rid of it. The stuff that you normally do, edit out all your ums, and then save those tracks again. Save them in Wave, take those waves, upload them, boom. You're going to be amazed at the quality that you get out of it, what it does for you. I think you'll end up spending the $90 same as I did. If you do a podcast, this is the way to go. You definitely need this. Do your editing in the free editing software, but do all the compression and all that production stuff that you have to do that you just don't know what to do. You don't know how. Do that in Auphonic. It's awesome. Well, that's our show for the week.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode103.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. We'll be right back. This is a URS production.